are accessible. For more information, please call 510-388-4932 or go to lapena.org. That is lapena.org.
And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 2 p.m. Stay tuned next for the Visionary Activist Show.
Welcome, allies, excuse me, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So, once again, we convene at a time of roiling cruelty in the world to strengthen beauty. So, more than perfectly, we are hosting longtime ally Deborah Felmuth, ongoing Blessing Beauty Poker. So Deborah Felmuth is unfurling her book, Syria, Remember Me, that we may keep intimacy with the people, the culture, the land of Syria, seeing beauty emerging from the rubble. By remembering, we contribute to reweaving the magic carpet that has been torn asunder. And wherever there may be uninitiated Mars, rampant and destructive, let Venus, beauty, and kinship arise to guide us to global renaissance. Before I bring Deborah in, just one note. There are many kinds of stories. There's 20, 30, 40 stories all roiling simultaneously, and they can all be conflicting and they can all be true. Which ones are we going to dedicate to? So part of the beauty of the Paris talks, regardless of corporate criminality and all of those things, is that the Paris talks will end on December 11th, which is a new moon in Sagittarius, at what astrologers have been calling for decades the global warming degree, 19 plus Sagittarius, whose image is cutting ice for cyclical summer use, gathering together, to create a future world. And we go, ah. So again, we honor and welcome Deborah reporting in from Vermont. Welcome, Deborah Felmuth.
Thank you so much. I am really, really very, very happy to be with you.
Well, it's perfect timing because we want to, wherever, again, there's we want to find the beauty, which you've so done, as it says on the back flap of your beautiful book just coming out now, this book is a love letter to Syria and to her people, a grief song of praise. And we go, it's so wonderful.
Mashallah.
Mashallah. Marhaba, Habibti.
Marhabdaini, Habibti. It's really good to hear your voice, and I'm happy.
Yeah, and it is such a time to find the beauty of Arab culture and the beauty of Syria and the beauty of the strong feminine in Islam, excavated. We go, put to one side the dogma and go for the art and the intimacy and the people. As Ambassador Thomas Pickering, who wrote the foreword to your beautiful book, Syria, Remember Me, he says, it's a Syria we will not see again or for a very long time. So, beauty, poignancy, kinship.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever see the movie or the book, which is Image Before My Eyes? It's an incredible book about photographs from the Warsaw Ghetto before the Holocaust of such exquisite complexity. You go, then it ends right before the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
So your book, I think, is very like that, that we can honor the complexity and beauty and invoke it back. Yes.
Absolutely. And rather than, saying that it certainly isn't a eulogy and it is an honoring and it is, as he says, we may not see this again, or at least not for a very long time. He even in his foreword plants that seed of something that will rise again, and it's through the ingenuity and through the honoring, through the many threads of cultural strength that define the Syrian, that I think we will see Syria again changed, and yet having many, 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 many of the both ancient and modern qualities that we have so admired in, or I have so admired in being there, and that you too witnessed when you were there.
Yeah, and what I've often said is, you know, as we sometimes are translated into the ocean by putting on flippers, you, Deborah Falmouth, have been like putting on flippers to dive into the beautiful sea of Arab culture and Syria in particular, going, ooh.
Yeah.
And as there is so much cruelty and sorrow now, once again, we are not giving up on beauty. As we've animated together and continue in perpetuity, may it be so, beauty poker. You know, I see your act of beauty and raise you one. Here's even more beauty. So your beautiful, beautiful book of photographs that you took over a decade, really, in Syria when you were living there.
Two decades,
thank you.
Yeah, 1991 to 2011.
Ah.
Photographs really do span 20 years.
Yeah. And, you know, so the photographs are wonderful. The words are exquisite. And so here we are, radio to paint with words, you know, to animate and to transport people as though they could see the beauty of your book, which they can find. The book's website, remind everyone so they can go and find
it.
Yeah,
easy enough. SyriaRememberMe.com will take you to the website for the book, and you'll see many images there and a little bit of writing and an ability to contact me or to purchase a book if you should want to.
Yeah, and it is, I know you only made 500 copies, but is that the idea that then you might reprint more, yes?
I will certainly hope so. This is selling very well, I have to say. It's only been out a month. It was released in the first week of November, and here we are in the first week of December, and it's going really, really well. So it bodes well for reprinting, and I would like to do it again in the same way. It's beautifully done, hand-sewn binding and offset printed. And even though it's expensive in that form, I think it's every penny worth it. It has more than 200 color plates. So.
No, I do too. Absolutely. It is invaluable wealth and perfectly so needed timing right now, where we do want to spiral out the beauty and the intimacy as you've done over the years. And the qualities of medicine, you know, as you dive us in, you know, Syria, the whole realm, the longest continuously inhabited region of the globe, and one of whose powerful medicines has been something we very, very much need, syncretism, you know, of so many different traditions and cultures and gods and all and religions, you know, brewing together and at different times, absolutely, you know, in dynamic harmony. You say the genetic melding of many invaders, that until now, and may it be again, it's been able to dance and spiral and absorb, yeah?
Very much so, an extraordinary diversity, not only of ethnicities, but also of faiths. And this is the beauty of modern-day Syria had been, up until its most recent turmoil time, the extraordinary grace with which people of different backgrounds really cheek by jowl, they moved in the same spaces with grace. In fact, I wrote many times about how Syrians were really accustomed to living in quite tight quarters, and that's both a literal and a figurative sense, and yet they were very much individual and very much giving and forgiving of each other in their space and in their need for different practices. If we just take we could take an ancient example that moved into modern times, and that's the Umayyad Mosque in the center of Damascus, which is an extraordinary and beautiful site today, and very large when one walks into it. And there's a courtyarded area that is larger than a football field, let's call it, and an inner prayer space that is quite large. That before it was a mosque was a cathedral, and in fact, in the first 70 years after the conquest of Islam was shared by the Christians and the Muslims, until finally the Muslims bought the Christians out and the Christians built a cathedral not too far away. So, you know, it's very literal, it's very figurative. And of course, that site goes back even deeper. It's on top of a Roman temple, which was to the god Jupiter, and that on top of an Iron Age pagan temple to the god Hadad, the god of thunder.
Ah. And what are the wonderful in your food section? The wonderful kind of tubers that grow after winter lightning storms.
Oh yes, the kame are wonderful, wonderful. Yeah, that's a jump, but it's beautiful.
Well, here
we have the god of thunder,
right.
And in the winter time, it doesn't snow often, but it snows very little and very occasionally, but it rains hard. If the Syrians are lucky, it rains hard, because this is a very arid country. Much of the country is arid. So they wait for these winter rains, and then when the thunder and lightning strike in the desert, there are certain cracks that are telltale only to the Bedouin who are really skilled at hunting these desert truffles. They are in the mushroom family, and they are very delicious. They're called the potatoes of the thunder because
I love that. They're
quite hard, and they stick a knife into the desert ground, and they pop them up through these cracks, and then they sort them for size and color, and they are sold in late winter, early spring, and they are absolutely delicious. They're really, really good.
And I think that is part of all of the complexity and story that we want to honor, that, you know, wherever we go and wherever we think, you know, there's humans, yes, but there's also thunder potatoes and animals and plants and all of that we extend our loving concern and grace to, that under so much bombing and siege. But as always, Deborah, in our cahooting, you know, everything you say is reminds me of 10 stories. So let's bring in Jupiter in the astrological language, the god of the Roman temple to Jupiter. But Jupiter is the intelligence of stories. And as we're speaking now so beautifully and as a welcoming to you, the moon and Jupiter are conjoined in Virgo, which is the power of the woman storyteller with her medicine stories, and that would be you, and that is what wants to come alive. And again, the heartening stories that we gather, you from the culture and land of Syria, and we from the astro mythology, going, oh, humans, they're, you know, cooperators indeed are standing by. There's a beautiful dynamic of the power, the gathering of the medicine bundles and the medicine stories, and the new moon on the 11th, okay, we'll animate that. And then on Christmas Day, which is really part of the winter solstice, Uranus trickster stations and goes forward and bounds onto the world stage. And it is the Venusian woman storyteller hero within all of us that is coming alive now. Oh, and you're feeding her.
Fantastic.
So, you know, when we talk about syncretism, yes, and, you know, something I've been pondering with many people is the word secular, and how, in a way, we might want to expand it and transcend it, because it's a little bit of a booby prize. Because when you speak of Syria as the most secular was, really what we're talking about is the most inclusive, the most tolerant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and see, secular is sort of like, oh, not holy, but no, it includes. So I'm concerned citizens for, you know, composting the word secular for a while and just going inclusive, tolerant, embracing.
Very tolerant.
Yeah.
And this is a beautiful thing, because for all of the swirling faiths that one might find in the Syrian culture, one would also find the inclusion of not only what would be pre-Abrahamic religions, and these are the great roots of thunder and Jupiter and Astarte and Ishtar and all of the gods and goddesses, Atargatis, and the fish and the dove for peace and the fertility of the waters. All of these things would be interwoven without seams into also, I don't know what substitute word I can use for secular, that which includes the holy in its most devotional form to nature.
I'm nominating inclusive.
Inclusive is perfect.
As the word, you know.
Oh, I see. Great.
Syria was the most inclusive, you know, inclusive and tolerant are my two word nominations to compost secular and let it go have a rest.
Right.
Because as we dive for the end of the year, the dark of the year, you know, we get to throw many things into the cauldron, and all old words or metaphors that are happy to be, you know, have a rest and retire back. Stage for replenishment, and I'm tossing in secular as a booby prize, as a mean trick, and ladling out, because coyote ladles out spirals out of the cauldron to send them wafting. We go inclusive, because I think that's such a great switch, if I do say so myself. Going,
it's an excellent
inclusive
one.
And true, you know, and you know, everything real, everything symbolic, but there are some places. Well, that's even truer, and that was my experience of you guiding me through Syria. Is like that's where we met. We found the Aladdin's lamp. We found, but remember when you took us to the last Bedouin tent makers in Damascus?
Yeah.
And how beautiful that was, and how they appear in your book.
Yes.
And prayers for the well-being of all of these humans.
Prayers for the well-being of all those who are pictured and all of their relations, and all of those whom you met and all of their relations, whether they are pictured or not. All of these lives whom you have touched, you've spoken about them so many times, and with such reverence in your voice and with such delight in your heart. It's been, you know, it's a contagion almost to hear you talk about Syria. And so that's a great thing. And I think remembering is really an act of creation. It's a courageous act. It's the putting back together. In this minute, when we speak of it, we actually create it again. And I think it's a strong medicine that is very much needed today in the face of the hysteria and some of the rhetoric that is just inflammatory.
Oh, definitely. You know, and, you know, as I was perusing, more than perusing, delving into your book, I did find myself weeping. And then I thought, well, but Deborah, you lived there so long. You're married to wonderful Muawiyah, who lived there his whole life until very recently. You know, you have transformed your sorrow into beauty. Ah.
Yeah, and this is, you know, our good friend and ally Martine has always said that transmogrified, that's not the word he uses,
right.
Grief is, you know, the roots of violence. So when you transform the grief, and this is what I am really trying to do with this book, is to help people change their thoughts and their conversations so that we can change the way the world is thinking and acting, because we really do have some bad actors at the moment.
And just to bring Martine and salute his eloquence. He says, for lack of grief we go to war.
Yeah.
The art of grief. And again, you know, Syria knows well the art of grief. Your book Syria, Remember Me is the art of grief. It is, because grief is kinship. Grief is poignancy, is kinship. Going,
yeah.
And when I was weeping, it was weeping for the beauty and the concern. And when we were with the Bedouin tent makers, and I was so delighted to, you know, again, it's the goat hair. They're weaving from goat hair. That's what,
yes,
and
spun goat hair.
And goats, yes, also wonderful. We love goats. And that it is windproof and waterproof and all of that. And we go, ooh, a little windproof goat hair tent. Yes.
Here, I have a sound for you that I hope that your sound engineer will like, and it won't blow anybody's circuits, but listen to this.
Okay.
So that is the sound. I don't know if you got that.
We got it.
You got that? That's a camel bell.
Mm.
And, of course, you might have the camels and the goats and the sheep all out in the same area of desert if you were walking along. You might hear a lot of that beautiful sound.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The symphony. And in years past, you've played the sound also of the tin walla, the people selling tin, the people selling...
Yeah, all of the
that.
Different song chants that you would hear sometimes in the small towns and sometimes in the big cities, each one calling out with by definition, it's melody. You don't even hear the words from a block or two away, and you know that someone is selling. It could be, you know, the gas tank for your stove, or it could be, you know, little tiny cucumbers that are so fresh, they're tiny as baby fingers, is what that chant says. Or the seller of prayer beads, who, as he goes along, he says, Ishakwa alamin, to whom can we complain? To whom can we complain? You are eternal. You are eternal. And he's selling prayer beads, so wonderful.
And it does resonate everywhere that, you know, that we are keepers of stories, and then we're keepers of the biggest story, that we live in a storytelling creation, that everything is telling us its story by its shape and its color and its song, and to have a culture that is so attuned to that, so that blessing and music weave the day together. That's how it has been in Syria. And then to honor the tent makers in Damascus that you took us to, and may they be okay. And it was such a great metaphor that struck me, because Syria, you know, it was a tight, you know, a dictatorship, but within which people led their elegant lives. And when we came into the tent makers' long, narrow, tight, cramped quarters, and were so greeted, like, oh, we will make you coffee on the edge of the rushing brook. We'll make you coffee. And then they were spinning the length of the room and dancing so elegantly. And I go, oh, this is such a metaphor. Tight circumstance, you know, creates the art of dancing within it in every political and cultural way. It was like, oh, so tragic. And the humor and the irony and the dealing with constraint in so many creative ways. Again, all of this, you know, calling it to return. So the genetic melding of many.
Just recently, in conversation with a Syrian woman in Damascus who is an architect and who teaches at a university, and she said to me, "La tafi, la tafi, don't be afraid, don't be afraid. Nahnu Suriyin mitl al-mai. We Syrians, we are like the water." And I said, "Wow, wow!" And then I said, "But tell me more. I don't know what you're telling me." And she says, "If you close up the way for the water, it will go around. And we are just like that. If you close up the way in front of us here, we'll go there." And so she was very much saying, "Yeah, things. We are in a troubled time, and yet our creativity and our ingenuity and our ability to be in those tight spaces and live with grace will stand us in good stead, and we will go another way."
And with the spirit of welcoming and desert culture and Bedouin, you know, again, remembering the wonderful Bedouin woman who we knocked on the door to see the beehive houses, right? And she looks out warily again and says, oh, and then she goes, oh, strangers, how wonderful. Mm-hmm. And I want us to, all of us, to blast, you know, the hubbub, the cruelty, the ignorance about Syrian refugees, going, these are pilgrims who carry a great culture with them. We should be honored. You know, welcome, welcome. How wonderful that you've come. Tell us your stories. What a difficult journey you've had. Oh, my goodness. Few would survive with the pluck and resilience and humor and smiles. When you see, you know, again, Syrian refugees, pilgrims, really, you know, and with only what they could carry and their children, their babies, and smiling, and you go, oh, that is just amazing. Medicine, yeah. That they can do that. You know, welcome, welcome. How wonderful that you've come. What can we do for you?
Welcome, welcome is absolutely what we should be saying to all of them, and in all ways, with shelter and with food and with water and with work and with warmth of heart, that we might just allow them to rest. You know, there is an old poem that you know, mentions that even when your enemy comes to your door, you might give him 3 days of this shelter before you even asked him his business. You know, and this is just an old Bedouin poem, you know, stating how you might go around about it. Now, today, that 3 days we could take as a simple, you know, the metaphor for whatever is needed, the beginning, the middle, and the end. We need to give them what they need now, because they are in need, and we are them, and they are us. We're the same people. We're really cut from the same cloth, only we may have forgotten many of our deep roots, the ones that they've been preserving.
Well, I did find in the beautiful photographs in Siri Remember Me, even the cover photograph, that woman looks kind of like your sister.
Wow. I take that as a high compliment.
Wow, yeah.
I think she is just beautiful. And, you know, I want to say something about the title of the book. For those who haven't seen it or haven't read about it yet, the Remember Me is the voice of Syria speaking. It's Syria saying, remember me. So I'm not saying, Syria, remember me, Deborah. No, it's Syria saying, remember me. And if we have time, can I tell that story?
Yeah, is it? Do I say it Zaccarini?
Zaccarini.
Zaccarini, yes. So, you've told it before, and we love it. We love it. It cannot be told too many times, so please.
I love that. This is one of the stories, and I think that I want to honor Abu Shadi, who was the Hakawati in Damascus, who told the same stories over and over and over again in the Nofara Cafe there behind the Umayyad Mosque, you know, brandishing his sword and banging it on the table when, you know, Antar, the great hero, was going to, you know, slay one of his enemies in order to save Abla, the light of his eyes, you know. So in the great tradition of telling a story.
And the Hakawati, which is such a wonderful sounding word, is the storyteller, right?
Yes, the Hakawati.
The Hakawati.
And so I was on the Euphrates, that great queen of a river, and it was 2002 when coming along a great stretch with a bend in the river where the current was taking us to the outside of the bend, we saw a mother and her two children running along the bank, and they were doing that great triangulating math where they knew if we run, and those people aim with their boat, we're going to land at the same point on the riverbank, which we did. And she was a beautiful, really hardened woman with bright flashing eyes and that kind of a belly where you just go, there is so much wisdom in this woman, in her literal and physical strength. And her son held the boat, and her daughter was shy as a desert flower, the one you don't hardly see until you get very close, and even then it might close up on you. She wanted to ask questions but never would. She looked away every time I looked directly at her. And so the mother asked all the questions and wanted to know where we came from and where we were going and how we were eating and where we were sleeping and why we were wearing vests and boat shoes and things like that. And do you love Syria? And we told her we loved Syria, which was the absolute truth then and is the absolute truth now. And then it was time for us to go, so the boy pushed us. We were quickly picked up by that current again on the far side of the curve. The current was swift, and without even paddling, we were moving away. And I turned, and I went to wave to her, and I noticed that she was tugging on her finger and tugging really, really hard. And then, with a swift and very sure toss, she threw the ring from her finger to me. And she said, Zaccarini, which means in Arabic, remember me. And I caught the ring. And I have the ring. And it's in my desk in Damascus. So I need to go get it. I need to go and get it
my
desk in Damascus. And that was the command. And from that, and from many other things, the book had to grow.
And she's in the book with her.
She's in the book. And so is her daughter, and so is her son.
Right. Now, you do say it's a hand-rolled tobacco cigarette that she's holding, although it looks like it has a filter in the photo.
You know, that's a shadow.
Oh.
It really took a magnifying glass for us to determine, and we've decided, yep, it's the hand-rolled cigarette.
I'm going for that, because I still have, you know, I had my two little tobacco pouches. One completely fell apart, but one is you're waiting for the other tobacco pouch, but one I still have with me that I bought for, you know, the equivalent of a dollar in Hama?
In Hama.
Which is where the water wheels are.
Yes. The great water wheel.
And also, that is where you said, because I went through Syria with my purple streaked hair, and it was met very well in the mosque. See, where you cover up, but there's little bits, and they go, oh, how wonderful. But you did say, when we went to Hama, you said, we might be met with a little more alarm and wariness than in other places. But remember when we were at the with the tobacco people, they were like, "Hello, how wonderful!" And you were like, I guess not. I guess it is inclusive even here.
Totally inclusive.
Totally jolly.
Yeah, so, you know, it was a more conservative area.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I wonder what they'll think, and they loved it.
They did. And again, I remember every detail of the tobacco. They go, "We grow this, and it is only tobacco, no pesticide, no other thing, only tobacco." And
beautiful.
You know, and when you smoke it in a sacred way, it is good for you, and here's this tobacco pouch. And we had a great time hanging out.
Yeah.
And I do want to, again, you know, some of these things just to repeat the complexity, because as you took us, it will always be one of the most important journeys of my life, Deborah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you took us to be with your Bedouin friends, we as Western women, it's a quirky thing. We could be with the men and with the men from outside the family talking politics, and that was quite a hoot.
Mm-hmm.
And then the outside men would go away and the women would come in and we could be there too. Nobody else could have that access.
So I have to admit it was a great privilege, and I took the photographs because I was in those same that you were extraordinary situations and felt that I was almost continuously being given treasure.
Yes.
Yeah.
And also the complexity. So, because again, when we were driving through the harsh Bedouin landscape on our way to, but you had mentioned, you know, the complexity of photographing, that at one point, I guess somebody had told you it was, you know, haram. You know, they did not want it.
Well, I don't actually remember that. Most of the time, I mean, I always asked. You can be sure for every photograph that you see in the book, there was a question. And I really think, I'm not a professional photographer, but I am a good photographer, that my art of photography might be the art of relationship.
Yes.
Because I'm having a relationship with every single person that is photographed there. And so I always asked, and most often people would volunteer almost before I'd asked. They were eager for it. I think there were a few occasions when people said, no, don't take my picture. But rarely.
So we did find the rebab music that you sent us, so we're going to have a very short little musical break right now at the midpoint of our show.
Rebab, a one-stringed instrument.
And again, with Afghani friends, and I have all kinds of things, all kinds of projects I want to do with you, and here comes the rebab.
Okay.
Beautiful, the rubab, because Afghani friends, the rubab said ru is gate and bab is soul. It's the soul gate, and here's the variation. You say rubab.
Well, they are saying, I mean, and that's not in the Afghani language. That's in Arabic. Ruh is soul.
Ah,
right. Bab is gate, and because they would be speaking Urdu, and yet being Muslim and knowing the language of the Quran, they would definitely have that same. And one of the things they say about rubab, it's the same, certainly, is that it has the same quality as the landscape, and something about that, I think. It might be hard to imagine, and yet one of the things that I think Afghan and Syrian landscape have in common is this extraordinary long vistas with very little interruption and just the shape of the horizon. Now, there might be many things in between you and that horizon line, and yet the sky seems vast, the desert seems vast, the arid plains, even north of the Euphrates, are vast. And that's the sound, that there's, you know, gentle rolling and occasionally really wailing, not in that example that we just heard right now, but occasionally the rubab really wails, you know, almost a lament. And there's a lot of that, too, and I think appropriate for right now.
Yeah. And what we've spoken of often and is the incredible beauty and yearning of arabesque curves and the music and the call to prayer, which you sing so powerfully to have a woman sing it. But it, you know, and it's part of the haunting mystery of all of our lives that we look at all affinities as important clues. And so, as long as I can remember, for no obvious environmental reason, as a little girl, I always loved the call to prayer, and I loved the yearning of the music and the instruments, and going and as you so skillfully guided into the complexity, going, you know, because people say, oh, it's terrible for women, and then we go, the art, the feminine really is everywhere in complex ways, and we do go backwards to Arabian Nights and many things to go, it must have been really perfectly okay and dynamic for women heroes and redeemers, but you were such a great guide to speak about the incredible respect for women which permeated Syria and made it one of the safest places on the earth for women, which was such an important surprise to tell to the home team, because nobody knew, you know, I mean even left-wingers, you know, before I went were like, oh, and you said that's why the Syrians were so welcoming, because they knew all the nonsense that Western and Americans had to go through to get there, going, welcome, you've come, you've journeyed through the nonsense of ignorant dread.
Yes, it is almost running a gauntlet, or was at that time, you know, to get the visa and get the ticket without friends and neighbors and family, you know, collaring you and holding you back. And that's a sad truth. However, once arriving in Syria, I know what you're referencing, and that is throughout genuine, I'm going to call it genuine Islamic culture, because what we have now is such a distortion of Islamic culture that is being foisted onto the world stage with violence. So if we go back to genuine Islamic culture, we have what is the highest honor is given to women, because it is said that paradise lies at the foot of the mother. And so this means that there is no more holy status than that of womanhood, and therefore all women are to be protected at all times. And this is why traveling in the Islamic world is a very genuinely safe thing to do, unless you are in a place of extremism.
Yeah.
Now, I have to say that I traveled in northern Pakistan also in the 90s by myself, and it was the Afghani men who most dearly took care of me, because they were also travelers, and being Muslim, as the Pakistanis were, but they were traveling less. So I was on buses where it was more common for me to see other travelers. The Afghani men, sometimes I wouldn't get off the bus, would get on with a cup of tea and a mandarin orange for me. You know, they would serve me, because they would say, ah, there's a woman, she needs protection, she needs help. And that's something that people here hardly have any idea of.
Right, and which we want to honor and remember to put back together. But again, there's 20 stories that spin off from every word you speak, because when you said, yeah, the visas and everything. But I do treasure so much at the time going to get my visa from the Syrian embassy consulate in D.C. And at that point, I had the only thing I've ever bought on eBay, which was an American passport holder that said in English, French, and Arabic, I did not vote for Bush, right? And I just remember the consulate clerk or whatever looking at that, because it looked just like an official thing. And he goes, oh, a little smile, and he goes, you do not agree with the foreign policy of your Bush president? And I go, no. And he goes, you will have a very good time in Syria. It was just this wink, yeah. This irony, yeah. This, you know, oh, I so love, again, the medicine of irony forged, you know, and compassion and humor, because part of the medicine that we're brewing, and well, let me remind people, you're listening to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, and our wonderful guest is Deborah Felmuth with her beautiful book, Syria, Remember Me. And yes, we're weaving all of these, you know, complexities. And, you know, like South Africa, like, you know, in Syria, like in these places of tremendous hardship where there are places where people have every reason to be bitter and who mm-hmm. are, mm-hmm. and then every reason to be bitter and who aren't.
Yes.
You know, and that is the extraordinary medicine of South Africa and of Beirut and of Damascus, you know, that incredible, and that's the irony and the perspective and the humor and the capacity to hold multiple stories at once, which is also going back to our night with your Bedouin friends, because remember how incredibly informed and sophisticated they were about American politics.
Very informed and sophisticated. And before we go there, I just want to, you made me think of something about the refugees as well.
Yeah.
Which is they are holding this complexity, and while they are in need right now, and we need to respond to the immediacy of this, when we go to the back picture, we need to remember that what they want most is to go home.
Yes.
In other words, most, if not all, I won't say what percentage, want to return. And so what is important is that we not participate in any way in supporting the destruction of their country.
Right.
And that is really where our work lies here, because they are holding that complexity. They're saying, whoa, got to get away right now. Want to go home. And let it be that I will be able to rebuild where I go to, that I won't find such destruction.
Because I know, and what a an amazing and quirky diaspora, and may it be out and a boomerang home. I don't know if you saw the Washington Post article about Syrian refugees arriving in the Arctic Circle in the northernmost town of Finland, with a population of like 300. Are these arriving, you know, Syrian refugees in the Arctic Circle? And it's like, oh my god, oh my god.
Clothes, lots and lots and lots of clothes.
Right. And many people welcoming, and many hate groups, you know, and we go, oh, Lordy, you know, and I want to always honor, you know, ally Steve Behrman, who says, you know, the answer to the drug problem is improve reality. And we go, yes, and the answer to the refugee problem is improve reality. Everyone wants to go home.
Right.
Everyone wants to go home. You know, when
you
I was
know, there's a beautiful song.
And
I just want to sing a little bit.
Please.
I can't play it because I got to hold the telephone. But,
right.
But it sounds like this. No, that's okay. Nesam halin al hawa min mafra al wadi ya hawa dakhl al hawa hudni al bladi. And that means The wind is breezing over us. It's just wafting over us from the valley. And oh wind, take me home. Take me back to my country. Yahawa, Yahawa, Yalli tayir bilhawa, Fimanturo tausura, Hudni andon Yahawa. So it's hawa is the word for wind, that breeze. And they're saying, oh, it's the scent of that flower. It's the memory of that sound that also came on the breeze. Take me home, take me home, take me home.
Ah, and you know, the ring in your desk in Damascus.
Yeah.
Well, it has great power. Rings have great power.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to say, you know, to you and to your beloved husband, you know, again, may you be able to return to your beautiful home in Damascus, and all beings, you know, and may the ring be hopping up and down now going, oh, the ring is such an honored by this beautiful book, the ring of again, remember me, say it again, remember me.
Yeah, SyriaRememberMe.com, go there. It means Zekarini.
Yeah.
Everybody should say that. Zekarini.
Zekarini.
Zekarini, because Zekarini. Isn't it the most powerful thing in the world? People everywhere want to be remembered. Don't forget me. Remember me.
Right.
Remember me. Don't forget me. Zaccherini. Zaccherini.
That is so true. You know, and in all the journeys, I remember, again, as a very young person, you know, madly traveling alone through India at the age of 18 as well, and with these important encounters of sharing stories, and when leaving, yes, they would say, you know, the man who ran the beautiful, beautiful restaurant in the train station in Hardwar, you know, again, remember me. Yeah, well, we are aspiring, you know, of all the people and the diversity, the inclusive diversity of the world. You know, let the whole world remember in this way, because as you speak of, you know, the Dora Europa's site, mm-hmm. right, the multi-ethnic, poly-religious citizenry who spoke, this is from you, who spoke Greek, Latin, you know, something else, Parthian, Middle Persian, Hebrew, Aramaic, the Jewish synagogue, the Palmyrene gods, you know, all of that, again, that is all there, and again, the once existing, until about a minute ago, you know, 2,000-year-old temple to Baal in Palmyra that we visited, the temple to inclusive tolerance. Ah!
Yeah. Well, and that we remember, and I want to bring this back for you to bring it back into the stars again, because we are all of that stardust. I mean, with those Palmyrians and those residents of Dura Oropus, this is 3rd century, so almost 2,000 years ago, we are made the atoms of carbon and the molecules of our beings, which they hold in that land, are in us too. So I want to really make a call to all listeners and go, the very fact that the universe has conspired that we should all be in the same soundscape together, listening to this radio show and speaking through this radio show, is a miracle of creation. And remembering, we can create something much more beautiful than what is happening in those who seek destruction.
Yes, and that each being who breathes is a unique experiment on the part of the divine. You know, it's, I think it's Jung's quote. He says, you know, each being in a unique experiment with which the divine was going to, you know, amplify some better Jungian quote. But anyway, but yes, again, the reverence for life. But on my notes that I've been taking on your beautiful book, Syria, Remember Me. It all kind of fits together, because there's the Dura Europa site with multi-ethnic Bali, you know, with Jewish synagogues and temples to everything, all there, you know, may the past be the future. Again, so much of may the past be the future, but right above it in my note-taking about your section of People of the Euphrates, I love that the photograph of the two fishermen, and they gave you a fish.
It was Easter, and I was outside the tent at about, near sunrise. It was after sunrise, probably 6 in the morning, and this was in early April, and they were heading downriver. And about 2.5 hours later, Esselina, my Dutch friend, and I were sitting, and we were having our morning coffee and packing up the tent and everything and putting it back into the boat to get on to the river. And they were, at this point, then paddling upstream, and they stopped where we were, and they brought us a fish, saying, "It is your feast day today, isn't it?" And these are very devout Muslim men. They had, you know, we had met them the night before. And they had said, "Yes, yes, you will be safe here. This is my grandfather's land. If you should need anything, you should, you know, come to us. We live in that village. You should come and stay in the village." We said, "No, no, no, we want to camp here." And they said, "Well, you'll be fine." And when they came back, they gave us a fish. And they said, "It is your feast day." And it was Easter.
I know, I love that. I wrote it down. It is your feast day today, is it not? And it's just so elegant, and charming, and wonderful. Again, yes, the honoring of all, you know, and they knew.
They knew.
Yeah. And People of the Euphrates. And again, it's that rich, again, syncretic tolerance, which is part of, I mean, the roots of civilization are in this land.
Right.
And as you say, you know, you quote the Quran, and maybe you can give us the Arabic, but everything living comes from the water.
Oh, this is one of my most dear quotes, and وَجَعَلْنَا مِنَ الْمَعْ كُلُّ شَيْءٍ حَيٍّ. everything living comes from the water. And ain't that the truth?
And so much of our shared heritage, you know, and listen up, you biblical Christians, this is the important land here to protect. I love that the archaeological sites are called tells.
You know. Yeah, tells. So it's what a wonderful, it's really the word for a hill. So, and because here we are in Syria is the northernmost end of the Great Rift Valley. And so that there have been many, many earthquakes, and there have been many, many centuries, and there have many, many reasons, even out in the desert where blowing sand alone would be a reason to cover something. But there are these hills that are not natural, but they are formed because there was something there, and then either it collapsed and things were piled on top of it, or the sand just blew and surrounded it. And that's what happened with Dora Oropus, where it was so well preserved in the sand for almost 2,000 years that it was called the Pompeii of the desert when it was uncovered right after World War One.
Yes.
And it had been perfectly preserved, and beautiful artwork, unbelievable. I mean, it would make Paul Klee jealous if he saw it. Beautiful black and white abstract art on the walls of some of the buildings in Dora Oropos. Yeah.
And then right next to that, close by in my notes, and I think in your book, you know, you have a photo of these beautiful girls carrying small scythes to gather grasses for the animals.
Gorgeous.
But also one thing I want to tease forth is that they're wearing beautiful clothes every day.
Yes.
Yeah.
So these girls are dressed in pink and red and green and blue. Their dresses are long to their ankles, and they've got colorful socks and beautiful plastic shoes on. I have a pair of plastic shoes that I got in Homes, and they are fantastic for the garden.
Right.
They're the best. But anyway, they have their dresses are belted. So they're long galabeas, but they're belted. And each one has a small hand sickle, and they are cutting grass for their animals, and they all of their are wearing kerchiefs, and so they are quote unquote veiled, but really they're just tying their hair back, and one of them adorably has on a cap that says Reebok.
I know, I saw that, and one of them is wearing a quite transparent dress. But beautiful, and again the idea of beauty and art everywhere, as you've guided us through the years. You know, it is a culture of, you know, anything else, you know, Salamtek, only your piece of beauty and beautiful clothes worn in the desert, just because, you know, beauty everywhere.
There's a beautiful expression that says, we eat for ourselves, but we dress for others. Meaning that, yes, you can eat whatever you want. If you want to eat a bite of this with a bite of that, that's up to you. In other words, your nourishment that you're taking inside you, it's up to you. And if you don't like pickles, don't eat pickles. But when you dress, you are dressing for others, because others will see you. And so you actually want to feed them, nourish them with your beauty.
And again, a great value of this book, Syria, Remember Me, is we want to remember the names, because so many Americans, I mean, even Mark Twain said the Americans learn geography by going to war. Mm-hmm. But you mentioned that the great market towns like Raqqa, you know, where there's yogurt and cheese and milk of sheep and goats. And we go, Raqqa. You know, now people learn Raqqa. Oh, it's the head of, you know, Daesh. And we go, no, Raqqa before that was full of markets and yogurt and cheese and milk and those beautiful things. Again, remember before.
And what we need to remember is that there is still yogurt and milk and cheese in Raqqa. And so this is the complexity that we need to, as you said, we need to choose to which story do we dedicate. And the Raqqa of the capital of the Islamic Caliphate and the Raqqa of yogurt and cheese is the same place on the Euphrates. And we need to know which one it is that we are supporting, and I support life.
Yes, sheep milk and cheese and beauty coming in from the desert and all of that, and the animals, and may the animals be safe as well, and the camels and the sheep.
Very near the summer palace of Harun al-Rashid,
who was
the caliph.
I know Harun.
Of course you do. Yes. Harun al-Rashid of Scheherazade.
Right.
So now, very near Raqqa, there is a palace that is entirely made out of quartz the ruins of which are remarkable, and sadly did not make it into the book with a photograph. But the quartz is just exquisite, and the stones, particularly if you are there either at near sunrise or near sunset when you have the low slanting light, you see the glint of this, the remains of this palace, which has very large underground cisterns for water. And in the desert, making, you know, these wonderful places to capture water when it's available so that at all times you might have it, are thousands of years old. Thousands of years old.
And as far as we know, Harun al-Rashid's quartz palace ruins are okay?
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. Yes, they are. And this is called a Resafe. Resafe. R-E-S-A-F-E.
And again, just the clues, as we were driving by the Golan Heights, you go, there's the Golan Heights, and they're desirable because that's where water is. It's like, of course, that's why they're under contention.
The headwaters of the Jordan River lie there, and of course, Syria, as a very, very arid country, needs that water, and Israel has said, we want it too, and they've got it.
Well, and remember, the headwaters of the Jordan River begin in a cave sacred to Pan. It's like, let's keep going further back to the source of the river, further back to the source of the symbolic river, you know, to where it's all, it's all nature, all of that. We have a few more minutes. I want to honor also, you know, you have a whole section, the agricultural village life, the diverse ecosystems, and certainly with the Paris talks, I mean, and everything, it's true, you know, part of it's all one story of the
story and
climate
change. I was so happy to see the Prince Charles started talking about it. I've been talking about it for a long time and saying, yes, drought is part of the root here.
Yeah.
And many refugees are walking north from southern climes because the southern climes are the ones that are feeling the heat first, and the agricultural sectors are perishing, and therefore the economic sectors are, and people need work and they need life.
And the crippling drought, you say, in the early 2000s, the shift to cities, and again, the loss of intimacy with the land. And we know that, you know, Palestinians and Israeli farmers have more in common with each other, so they say, than with the governments, and so all dedicated to the land. Yes, all of that.
Yeah.
And then let's just do a little, I guess, a shout out, and then I want to toss it to you for, you know, but the Arc of the Fertile Crescent, you know, that, you know, the oldest, you know, so many olive trees, the fourth largest producer of olive oil after Spain, Italy, Greece, and in the early 21st century. And Aleppo, pistachios and walnuts and almonds and pomegranates. And I hand it to you, Deborah, to however you want to say a blessing on our way out now.
Oh, I want to say a blessing. There was a site on the north called Jurf al Ahmar. And when the water was rising there because a second dam was being built, and the villagers were given building materials to move their home.
We're going out now.
Further away.
No, go. Take 10 seconds. Take 10 seconds.
Be el khair, inshallah, o Allah yatik al afya. Inshallah, Suriya, the dal daiman bi khair.
Thank you so much, Deborah Felmuth. We will be in cahoots in perpetuity. Your beautiful book, Syria, Remember Me. I want to thank always Toby Schreiner in Washington, D.C., and Erica Bridgman in Berkeley. I'm Caroline Casey, wishing all of us well. And again, we are not giving up on beauty. We are honoring beauty everywhere. Thank you again, Deborah.
Go to SyriaRememberMe.com.
Yes, what a good idea. One more.
Are you tired of The Matrix?
The movie?
No, not the movie, but the one you're living in. If so, then hang out with your friends at The Full Circle.
What's The Full Circle?
Full Circle is a radio show written, produced, and directed by apprentices right here at KPFA. We'll bring you everything from the obscure to the obvious, the hidden and the blatant, as well as all things in between. So be informed. Hear about your world community every Friday night from 7 to 8 p.m. on 94.1 FM, where we'll serve you the red pill with love.
Part of our mission at KPFA is to foster real change. In 2015, we presented a distinguished group of people speaking out on issues vital for our community's rights, health, and welfare. The voices of Chris Hedges, Ta-Nehisi Coates, Alicia Garza, Dee Watkins, and Phyllis Bennis, to mention a few. 2016 is an important election year, and to provide you with alternative coverage, we'll need your support. Our next fund drive is December 8th. Help KPFA foster real change. Thank you.
This is Brian Edwards Tiekert, host of KPFA's Upfront. Every weekday morning at 7 a.m., we deliver a mix of reporting, interviews, and debates, where we ask the hard questions and go deep. From City Hall to the Middle East and pretty much everywhere in between, start your morning with Upfront at 7 a.m., right after Democracy Now!, right here on KPFA.
And you are listening to 94.1 and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley.